from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Education historian and author Diane Ravitch joins us to discuss her new book, Reign of Error, in the opening hour of Forum. She explores in the book what she calls the hoax of the privatization movement and how she thinks it's harming public schools. She's a research professor of education at New York University, and she'll be with us in studio. And that's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Diane Ravitch joins us for this morning's opening Forum Hour, an education historian and research professor of education at New York University. She served in both the Clinton and Bush administrations and received a great deal of attention when she switched her positions on such issues as privatization of schools, school testing, and No Child Left Behind. She recently published her 11th book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And in 2011, she was a recipient of the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Prize from the American Academy of Political and Social Science. And we welcome her back to Forum. Good to have you here. Welcome again.
Thank you, Michael. I love your show.
Thank you for that. You're still getting pilloried, though. Let's begin by talking about this. As if somebody can't change, I guess, and decide that one policy is not necessarily the policy they want to stand behind for the rest of their lives, or do a turnaround or a flip-flop or whatever you want to call it. I mean, you helped conceive the reform movement, so I suppose a lot of people still remain angry because they think, boy, you had all this money behind you with Silicon Valley and corporate sponsors and patrons and all that, not to mention, the Gates Foundation, and boom, now you're back with the unions. I mean, that's kind of how it plays to some people.
Right.
Or how could she have aligned herself with the right and now she's back with the reformers or the progressives? That's how it plays to others.
Right. Well, I think it's a little bit of an overstatement. First of all, I've never received a penny from the Gates Foundation. And it's true, I was embedded in two very right-wing think tanks. And I was there for many years. So they are very angry at me because I was privy to all the discussions. I believed what they believed, but I believed it because I thought that the ideas we were talking about, the strategies of testing, accountability, choice, and competition, that these would actually produce improvements, that education would get better if there were more testing. It would concentrate the mind, and we should hold people accountable for results and all that. And then over time, as the results of No Child Left Behind came rolling in, and by the way, I was not an architect of No Child Left Behind. People often say that, but it's not true. I certainly approved of No Child Left Behind, but then so did Ted Kennedy, so did George Miller. And George Miller still cheers for it. The difference between us is he's still in favor of No Child Left Behind. But I came to see it in about late 2006, early 2007, that all the things that I had been supporting inside these right-wing think tanks was not only not working, but turning into a disaster. And it was at that time that I started writing the book in which I announced my that I had given up on these bad ideas, that I denounced them, that I said I was wrong. And apparently this, and the culture we live in today, this very adversarial culture, it's a terrible thing to say I was wrong and I'm going to try to make up for it. But that's what I said, and I'm trying my best to find a better way to support teachers, to support parents, to support children, to support American public education. And I think that's where the fight is today.
Was it also, I know you didn't enrich yourself or put anything in your bank account, but was it also perhaps somewhat alluring to go on that side of things because there was so much money behind it? Because you thought money could solve the problem?
Wait a minute, to go on which side? The left or the right?
No, the side that you were on.
Oh, No, I was never attracted by money. For one thing,
I don't mean you personally. I mean the fact that money could solve or ameliorate the problems. Well, there's a lot of money behind that reform movement.
I actually didn't see it that way. I mean, personally, obviously, I didn't because I happen to have been married to an incredibly wealthy guy from whom I'm now divorced. I'm financially independent. So it makes me laugh when people say, oh, I sold out to the unions. Why would I sell out to the unions? I don't need to sell out to anybody. I didn't sell out when I was on the side of the Hoover Institution. Actually, at Hoover, there are some incredibly brilliant people, and I learned a lot arguing with and talking with, you know, people like Eric Hanushek, John Chubb, Terry Moe. I disagreed with them. We had wonderful disagreements, but they're brilliant. I don't take anything away from them, but I now disagree with them, and I don't think anybody is there for the money. I wasn't there for the money. I was there for the companionship, for the fun, for the opportunity to argue about ideas. And we just disagree. I disagree vehemently with what they're doing, but I was on their side until a few years ago.
So your new book really comes out against privatization and comes out against it once again as hurting the schools and charter schools, particularly being hurtful, even though there are some good ones, as you've often acknowledged. But they are a hoax. Why are they a hoax?
Well, I think the hoax is the whole privatization movement. The first hoax is saying that this is reform when it's not reform. And I find myself stumbling over the word reform when I see it attached to people like Bill Gates, Arne Duncan, Joel Klein, Michelle Rhee. I go through the whole litany. I mean, this is the status quo. So when these guys say they're the reformers, they are, in fact, the status quo. Arne Duncan's the U.S. Secretary of Education. He has the power of the federal government and billions of dollars behind him. He has commanded almost every public school in the nation to do as he wishes. And to call himself a reformer when he owns the levers of power, it doesn't make any sense. To call Bill Gates a reformer when he controls some, I don't know, $30, $40, $50 billion, and the whole nation is now dancing to his tune, I guess I would say it's a joke, but I might say it was a hoax. In fact, this whole crowd of people who now call themselves reformers are privatizers. The reason that I'm critical of the charter movement is that it has strayed so far from its original purpose. The original purpose of charters was to do what public schools couldn't do or did badly. They were supposed to, and I document this in the book, as in my previous book as well, the original purpose was that they would find the dropouts. They would bring the dropouts back. They would find innovative ways to engage kids who were totally turned off of school. They would not be judged by test scores because they were taking the most challenging students, the most difficult students.
Too often they turn them away, though, don't they?
Well, what's happened, and this is why it's a great hoax, is that the charter schools now seek out the highest performing students in the poorest communities, and they have been criticized even by federal agencies for having disproportionately small numbers of students with disabilities. They usually accept very small proportions of students who are English language learners. So, and then they kick out the kids with low test scores. So instead of doing what they were supposed to do originally, which is to help the public schools, they now see themselves as aggressive competitors, as entrepreneurs, and in competition with the public schools to get higher test scores. That was not the purpose. So I would love to see them return to their original purpose, and then I would become a supporter of charters.
Well, in many instances, as you point out, they've been taken over by entrepreneurs or for-profit people.
Well, this is the sad thing is, like in the state of Michigan, and my book is a national book, in the state of Michigan, more than 80% of the charter schools are run for profit. And there are districts there which went into deficit or which had very low test scores, where the governor, who's a far right-wing reactionary governor, gave the entire school district to a for-profit charter chain. And this has happened in at least two districts so far. What I see as I look around the country is urban districts being charterized and taken over by, in many cases, for-profit entrepreneurs.
Your argument really, and it's been a consistent argument since you've done the turnaround, is that education shouldn't be a consumer product. It should be a social and political responsibility. And there are many people who are obviously sympathetic and in support of you there. But the public schools, in some instances, I know they're doing better now in terms of test scores. There's a lot of data that suggests that things have been turned around to a degree. But the low performers, the low performing schools, you know, it almost would seem like it would take an economic miracle to really change some of them.
Well, I don't think that schools should be judged by test scores to begin with. If you knew—
I'm not talking about test scores. I'm just talking about the fact that the kids aren't performing and the kids are dropping out and the lack of resources that makes it impossible sometimes to really move ahead because of concentrated poverty.
Well, the what I say in the book, and I believe this is true, is, first of all, the big news is that the reformer narrative is a hoax. The schools are not declining. If you look at American education, and I have the graphs in the book, it's very unusual for Knopf to publish a book that contains graphs in it. But I have U.S. government graphs showing that actually across the country, test scores are higher than ever for white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, and Asian kids. Dropout rates are the lowest in history. High school graduation rates are the highest in history. And where there is low performance, where there are schools that are really in trouble, it's where there's a concentration of high poverty and high racial segregation. Mm-hmm. And we're doing nothing about those. It's as though we've decided not to talk about the root causes. And what schools are doing, or what districts and cities and states are doing under Arne Duncan's direction, is to close those schools and start over. And that's called a turnaround. But closing a school does not address the problem. If a child can't read, if a child is struggling with math, he doesn't become a better reader or better at math because his school was closed. So I think that every time a school closes, the head of the school system, the superintendent, should be considered a failure because they have failed to provide that school the resources and the support and the help that it needed to improve what the students were doing.
You want a lot of the onus to be on the superintendents and administrators as opposed to where the onus presently is on the teachers, don't you?
Well, exactly. They're the ones who make the decisions about resources and who gets how much money and whether they're small enough class sizes. One of the key ways to improve the performance of students, their ability to read and write and learn, is to provide small classes.
But if you make the classes smaller, for example, in these suburban schools, which are doing very well, then the result, and put more of the resources into the schools that are segregated or that are in the inner urban areas, you're going to have perhaps a decline in the suburban schools, aren't you?
Well, I don't think you'll have a decline in suburban schools. I think that where the suburban schools tend to be nicely funded, in most parts of this country. And in fact, in most places, the suburban schools have far more to spend, and they spend it to have all the enrichment activities that the inner city kids don't have. I was just last week in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, and it's a very sad story when you see a marching band that has no instruments because they lost all the funding for the instruments. They lost the funding for the band director. They're wearing 12-year-old uniforms. No suburban parent would tolerate that, and yet this is what is happening in inner-city schools. So where the problems are the worst, the resources are now going to clusters of consultants, to turnaround firms, to all these entrepreneurs who fasten on the schools to take money that should be used to reduce class size, to make sure that there's a vibrant arts program, to make sure that they're getting the most experienced teachers instead of the teachers with only a few weeks of training. There's so many things that we could do, including making sure that there's early childhood education in these very same communities. And I can't help but think that if Arne Duncan, he had $5 billion to help reform the schools of America, he used it to create a competition to raise test scores. What if he had taken that that same $5 billion and used it instead as incentives to communities to promote the desegregation of their schools? I think it would have had a much larger impact. Or use the $5 billion to create health clinics in neighborhoods where there are no health clinics or where the school nurses have been stripped away.
Our guest is Diane Ravitch. She's research professor of education and historian of education at New York University. Her new book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And she'll be speaking at Stanford University Memorial Auditorium this evening at 6 o'clock. When we talk about smaller classes, we talk about better status for teachers, better salaries, better training. Everybody always looks to Finland, which is kind of a homogenous world, really, it doesn't have the diversity and heterogeneity that we have here in the United States. And yet, a lot of that sense of what is done in Finland, I think, from the perspective of you and many like you, could translate here, could be done here.
Well, it's true that Finland is homogenous and it's small. They have relatively few students compared to the U.S. But the Finnish experts, whom I know well and I visited the Finnish schools, will say that they got their best ideas from the United States. Only we forgot our best ideas. And that is to say that they have put an emphasis on having very well-prepared teachers. It's difficult in Finland. This is
You have to have an MA, I think, even just to teach there, don't you?
Well, to get first of all, you enter the teaching program right out of high school. And the young kids, teaching is such a respected profession that there are 10 applicants for every place in the teaching institutions. There are only 8 of them in the entire country. So they accept 1 out of 10. They then spend 5 years preparing to become a teacher. That involves deep knowledge of their subject matter and also a lot of practice teaching, understanding how to work with kids with disabilities. And they become excellent teachers. And day one, when they enter the classroom, they're good teachers. They all belong to a union. All the teachers and all the principals belong to the same union. And what I hear as I travel around this country is we need to be able to fire teachers. We need to be able to get rid of the unions. We have to take away tenure. And yet we look at Finland, which has a very fine public school system, where they want every school to be a good school. They're doing the very opposite of what we're doing.
Well, we also, it would be wonderful if we could inspire young people to want to be teachers now. To a great extent, that was true maybe 20, 30 years ago, much more than it is today. But how we do about dead wood? I mean, you must concede that the union does protect some people who probably shouldn't be in the classroom and don't have any desire to inspire students anymore, just kind of sleepwalking like zombies.
Well, I think that dead wood should be fired. But dead wood...
It's hard, though, with the unions.
Well, you know, what the unions do is insist that people have due process. I don't have a problem with due process, but it should be timely due process. And this is what I say in the book. I don't actually believe in seniority. I do believe in tenure. I think that teachers should have the right, which is not a lifetime protection for teachers, unlike higher education. In higher education, tenure means lifetime job. In K-12, it means you have a right to a hearing. And if your principal has observed you over a 3 or 4 year period, depending on state law, and decided that you are worthy of tenure, at that point, once you're tenured, you have a right to a hearing before an independent arbitrator. You have to present evidence before you're fired. Otherwise, people will be fired because if, let's say, in some states, they'll be fired because they tried to teach evolution. I mean, what tenure does is it protects academic freedom, and even teachers need academic freedom. There will be teachers fired because they taught controversial books. There will be teachers fired because they taught global warming. I think it's very important that even K-12 teachers have the freedom to teach what some members of the community might object to. Just last week, a school board in North Carolina voted to ban the teaching of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. And a teacher who dared to teach it would have been fired. Fortunately, they've reversed their decision because they became an object of ridicule.
What was that based on?
One parent said she thought it was a filthy book. And so the school board voted 5-2 to ban the book.
It's a book I know very well, and I'm trying to think of what could even be postulated as being filthy in it under any circumstances. We're talking again with Diane Ravitch. Her new book is Reign of Error. There's, again, the sense in your book of charters being harmful the way they presently are, the need to go back to the original mission of what charter schools were supposed to be and so forth. But you hear this argument from parents who say, this is a matter of choice. I don't like the fact that my kids are going to go to a neighborhood school because I think the neighborhood school isn't performing the way I'd like to. So the charter school is an option for me. It's all about choice.
Well, the choice argument, it's kind of ironic. Choice used to be the code word of the far right. Choice was the word you heard from George Wallace, the governor of Alabama. It's was the code word of people like Strom Thurmond. And what this is an effort that's underway to turn schooling into a consumer choice, a consumer good, as opposed to being a civic obligation. I strongly believe, and I have a piece, by the way, tomorrow in the Los Angeles Times, which should cause a bit of a stir in L.A., which has more charters than any other city in America. But I strongly believe that public schools are a public obligation. It's a civic responsibility. Whether your child, if you want to make a choice to send your child to parochial school, that's okay. Private school, that's okay. Just don't expect the government to pay for it. If you have no children, you too have to pay for public schools because it's a public obligation, just like paying for police protection, fire protection, even though you don't need the police and you don't have a fire in your house. This is part of your civic obligation. Public schools are part of what makes a free democratic society. And my own personal preference would be to have a good public school in every neighborhood. And it's the responsibility of those in positions of leadership to try to make that happen, not based on test scores, but based on asking that simple question, what makes a good public school? What makes a really good neighborhood school? And then making sure that the school has the resources so that it is a good public school.
And I believe it's safe for me to say that, without sounding like I'm editorializing, that you and I are on the same page in terms of the importance of pre-K and the importance of arts in education. But there's more and more movement toward technology and technology replacing teachers. Do you inveigh against this for the most part?
Or well, I'm all in favor of teachers using technology, and I've seen some fantastic demonstrations. I've been to conferences like there's something called the Q Conference, which is California educators using technology, and teachers do amazing things in terms of bringing history to life. Instead of reading about FDR, you actually see him giving speeches. Instead of reading about World War II, you actually see the things that happened and where it happened. And it's very exciting when you see these, how teachers can bring history and science and other subjects into the real lives of real children. What's happening with technology, however, is that it has become a way of entrepreneurs to mine to the education industry. And there is such a thing now called the education industry. There are companies trading on Wall Street based on their ability to extract dollars from taxpayers to provide either tech products or, in some cases, really shoddy online charter schools. I mean, the worst thing in the entire education industry are the online charter schools. And I have a chapter devoted to what a scam that is, and they provide very bad education. We now have lots of companies vying to create the product. And I think the one interesting thing about the tablet idea is that instead of kids carrying six textbooks, each of which weighs 7 pounds and has 1,000 pages, you can get it all on a tablet. The problem that no one has solved, however, is what happens when the tablets are lost. Kids lose things. What happens when they're stolen? What happens when the technology breaks down, as it does? And just in Los Angeles, the LAUSD decided to spend $1 billion on iPads instead of this was money taken from 25-year school construction bonds, which I think someone should take them to court on this. I think it's absolutely disgraceful.
It also takes more money away from arts education, as I was trying to imply by the way I framed the question.
Well, it takes money away in this case from just repairing schools.
From everything, maintenance,
from everything.
Yeah.
And then the iPads, I don't think we're quite ready for the technological revolution, because I think the first thing that kids need, if they can't read and write, is they need real teachers. They need someone who looks in their eyes and helps them and can answer their questions on the spot, not an iPad.
Well, if you have one adversary, chief adversary, of course, it's probably Michelle Rhee. And when she was on last, I was talking about testing, of course, and testing from a vantage point of, all the ill effects and consequences of putting too much of emphasis on testing, people teaching to the test and cheating that goes on in testing, all that sort of thing. But how will we measure student performance if not by test? What metric would you have?
Well, I don't think the metrics exist to measure good schools. It's certainly not test scores. And I say this having spent 7 years on the National Assessment Governing Board. The tests are so flawed. There are many tests that have questions where there are two answers. There are many tests where there is no right answer. There are many tests where the wise child picks the wrong answer because the question was badly worded. This is simply not a good enough instrument to judge either the quality of a student, the quality of a teacher, or the quality of a school. And
so the option is no instrument?
No, we don't have an instrument. There are no metrics. We have to use human judgment. I mean, if you go to your doctor, he may use metrics to say something about your heart rate, but he will not tell you, as you now we're now learning from the Common Core testing, he will not say, we have the answer, but we won't let you see it. We're just going to give you a score, but we're not going to tell you how to get better, because that's what's happening. That's what happened in New York with the Common Core testing. The results came in 4 months after the test, and the teachers learned nothing from it. As for Michelle Rhee being my chief adversary, I wish she would debate me. I've been trying to line up a debate with her, and she keeps avoiding it.
We'll see what we can do on that score. We're talking to Diane Ravitch, and again, her new book is Reign of Error, in which she explores what she calls the hoax of the privatization movement and how she thinks it's harming public schools, and we welcome your involvement in the program. Feel free to join us now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can do that at 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Diane Ravitch is our guest. Her new book is Reign of Error. It's all about privatization and charter schools. In fact, the subtitle is The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And she'll be speaking tonight at Stanford's University Memorial Auditorium at 6 p.m. In the meantime, you can certainly join the program. And I want to find out what our listeners are thinking. Actually, let me go to kind of two comments that are sort of at odds with one another. David writes, Reign of Error should be required reading for people interested or involved in education policy. Whether you agree or disagree with the arguments, the book is well-researched and full of important examples of what can go right or go wrong in education. Dan, on the other hand, writes, does Dr. Ravitch really think all charter schools are the same and that there's no place for any in our education system? The problem of education in this country is not a question of charter versus traditional, public business versus union, Republican versus Democrat. In presenting it so, Dr. Ravitch is doing a profound disservice to our country and its teachers, who she falsely claims to represent.
Well, first of all, I don't claim to represent anybody other than myself. Unlike some of other people envying on the subject of education, I have no staff. I have no foundation funding. All I have is 40-plus years of experience in the study of the history and politics of American education. As for all these dichotomies, unfortunately, there is a privatization movement. There is a threat and a danger to the future of public education. And there is this terrible testing movement that's turning schools into places of drudgery. And what I suggest in my book, I think your listener who made that question hasn't read my book. But what I suggest in the book is that what John Dewey says, and it's an epigram on the book, what the best and wisest parent wants for his child is what we should want for all the children of the community. And so when we look at the very fine suburban public schools, or for that matter, the elite private schools, what we see is experienced teachers, beautiful campuses, wonderful arts programs, athletic activities every day. We see imaginative teaching of all the subjects that matter: history, science, literature, math, foreign languages.
But how good are they with those students who are low performers, or how good are they with students who have, for example, second English language concerns in terms of not being able to express themselves as well, even though they may be very smart? They don't have the idioms. They don't have the way of grammar.
Well, what I would suggest is that, first of all, those schools are not taking the low-performing kids. But what the kids who are low-performing need is the same thing that the best schools have, only they need more of it. They need the arts programs. They need the wonderful playing fields. They need the athletic activities. They need reasons to come to school. And what they are now subjected to is the No Child Left Behind, race to the top mentality of, if you get tested, and prepare for the test all the time, your scores will go up and you'll get out of poverty, and poverty will end in America. And I say that that's, first of all, it's ridiculous. But secondly, it's a great distraction, as the whole charter movement is a great distraction. There is no high-performing nation in the world that has charter schools. We look at Finland and Korea as high-performing nations. They don't have charter schools. They don't have vouchers. They have created an excellent public school system. But what they've done that we have not done is to reduce child poverty. These are countries where you will find small numbers of kids in poverty, and we have almost 25% of the children in this country in poverty. And in urban districts where academic performance is low, the poverty levels are even higher. So if you wanted to say what's the root cause of low academic performance, it's high poverty and racial segregation. What are we doing about it? Nothing.
I want to get our callers on here. A lot of people want to talk to you, but I first have to ask you, since our State Attorney General Kamala Harris is actually holding a press conference right now as we speak to talk about the problem of truancy. About 1 million elementary school students in the state were truant. That's defined in California as 3 or more unexcused absences or tardies, and that was during the 2012-2013 school year. That's pretty serious.
I think it's very serious, and I think it's completely understandable. If I were a student in school today, I would probably be truant as well, because I would say I've had enough of the test prep. In schools across this country, and I'm sure in California as well, the tests have been so crucial in the lives of children and teachers and schools that in many cases, a month or more of the entire school year is devoted to preparing for these stupid tests. And if I knew that it was going to be another test prep day, I'd stay home or do something else. I'd go play.
The student, a listener named Juan, who writes on Facebook, the public school system has nothing to do with education and everything to do with indoctrination. Also, what works better, the DMV or Starbucks? I guess you get his point there, don't you? Privatization, Starbucks, DMV, state control.
Well, the difference is, if he's talking about the difference between public and private, I'd say that there's a lot to be said for the private sector, but there's – and I believe in a private sector. I visited the former Soviet Union, and it was lacking a private sector, and it was horrible. But there is also a lot to be said for having a strong public sector. And a country that doesn't have a strong public sector, that's completely privatized, is one that will experience dramatic extremes of wealth and poverty, as we are experiencing.
What's happened to the idea
today?
Of the commons, for example?
Well, the commons. And the commons is – that's the public sector. What it means is that as a citizen, I support you know, the roads should be free. They should not be privatized. We shouldn't have to pay a toll whenever we go into a street. The fire protection and police protection are free when we need – we don't have to pay whenever we call for them. Public parks should be free. They should not be privatized or handed over to developers to erect a condo. I mean, beaches should be open and free to the public. I mean, public schools should be free and available to the public. Private schools are better only to the extent that they're able to kick kids out, weed kids out, and educate only those who can afford to pay and pay very, very high prices. So that makes them better. But public schools have an obligation to educate everybody. And the latest Gallup, it's called the Gallup Phi Delta Kappa poll, shows that when people are asked, how's your neighborhood public school, they overwhelmingly say, I love my neighborhood public school. I love my teachers. So it's not that they're public that that's a bad thing. It's that what's happening today that's tragic is we have federal laws and federal programs that are ruining our public schools and making them places where children become truant because they're tired of being constantly tested.
And, you know, people will say the same thing about their local politicians. All politicians are bad and corrupt and venal, but not my congressman or congresswoman. Let me bring our callers on here. Bill, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I followed Diane's stuff for many years, and it's great, and I'm a public school advocate. But my daughter wants to be a high school English teacher, and she wants to get a master's credential in high school English. She's an Irish student from an Ivy League school, and she looks at the curriculum, and it doesn't really go deep into her subject matter, nor does it go deep into how to teach. It all seems like kind of freshman college sociology, trying to explain all the reasons kids don't learn, but doesn't really give her a grasp of how to be a better teacher. And I was just wondering if you could comment on, are our teachers being prepared in these master's programs to actually be quality teachers like you gave the example of Finland?
Well, I think that you're asking me to comment on the teachers' colleges, and they vary widely in terms of the quality of their preparation.
Well, forgive me, Diane. A master's degree doesn't necessarily prepare you to be an educator any more than a PhD or any other advanced degree.
He's talking about
the credential program.
Right, the credential program. I think what's key in preparing to be a teacher is, first of all, that your daughter has the mastery of her subject matter. That will provide her the content she needs. I don't think anyone should go into, certainly not into high school or junior high school teaching, probably not even into elementary teaching, without mastery of content, and she's got it. Hopefully what she's going to get in her master's program is knowledge of, let's say, how to teach kids with disabilities, because she will have them in her classes, and she will not have learned that in her undergraduate program. She'll learn a lot about the economics of education, the politics of education, the psychology of children. I mean, there are things that you can learn, and there are better and worse ed schools for sure. But I think that what she should learn is how to manage a class, and you don't learn that in your undergraduate training. And that's the biggest problem that most teachers face, is that she'll probably have a very large class size, and she'll have some kids who are not interested in learning, and she better learn classroom management.
Good luck to your daughter, Bill, and thank you for your call. I'm going to bring another caller on, and that's you, Tom. Join us.
Hi, good morning. I work in healthcare, and we also see a proliferation of computerization and focusing on metrics and how staff and employees are performing to metrics rather than taking care of business. And I wanted to kind of ask you, what do you think about the proliferation of online courses and how, if testing were done locally by local school principals and teachers, would that have kind of prevented withdrawing funds from underperforming schools, to throw more money at it rather than Leave No Child Behind's program of taking money away?
Well, that's a good question. And actually, I had an article on the New Republic blog this week because there was someone there who had written, we need more testing and we're not testing enough. And my response was that we're relying too much on the standardized tests because so many of them are so error-ridden. And what we should be doing is letting teachers prepare their own test. And there's a lot to be said for the teacher, first of all, because the teacher has taught the children and knows what they should be tested on. I mean, what the standardized tests do is make you teach to them instead of the teacher teaching the material and then testing the kids about whether they've learned it. But what the teacher gets by preparing his or her own test is that they're able instantly to get the feedback to find out what children haven't learned and then to give them the additional help they need to understand it. Also, the teacher can find out by looking at the test whether she's communicating. If it turns out that she thought she taught something and nobody got it, then the teacher immediately finds that out. You don't learn any of that from standardized tests. The results come in too late, and you don't get any opportunity to see what the kids answered and what they didn't understand. So I think that we have a huge problem with this widespread adoption of standardized testing. A lot of it has to do with the power of the testing industry. They have lobbyists working in D.C. They have lobbyists working in every state capital, and they are protecting their industry share. This is not about education. If we were concerned about education, we would have the bulk of the testing in the hands of the teachers.
Let me thank Tom for his call. James writes, I'm glad to hear Ms. Ravitch describe public education as a social obligation like police and fire. When people ask why they should pay to educate their neighbor's kids, I say because your neighbor's kids will soon be voting. Education and information are the lifeblood of any democracy. And Tracy writes, I'd like to underscore Dr. Ravitch's comment that education is part of the social contract. Representative Pat Schroeder said many years ago that education is infrastructure. She was right. For whatever you put into it, society as a whole gets more out of it, exactly as our transportation systems, power grids, communication systems, etc. Proper funding of education pays back far more than just the benefit to the individual child. I'll read more of your emails and Facebook remarks and the like in a while, but let me get more calls on. Denise is joining us next. Hi, Denise.
Hi, I'm so happy for this interview. I'm on my way to an IEP as we're speaking. And I would love to know her thoughts on whether or not Waldorf education prepares the kids for high school and college.
Well, I think that everything I know about Waldorf, and I have not had either children or grandchildren in a Waldorf school, but everything I know about it is that it's wonderful education. It focuses on arts and human interactions. I know that I've read recently in the New York Times a story about a Waldorf school in Silicon Valley where the top executives of the tech industry are sending their children to a private Waldorf school that has no technology at all because they say, well, they can always get that later on. It doesn't matter. What they want their children to do is to love learning. I think that's a wonderful goal. They're not concerned about measuring their kids or having data. They're just concerned about their love of learning.
In fact, I thank you for the call. A listener writes, you need to create a class in a school that students attend not because they are required to attend, but because they want to be there. The consumer of schools are students, not parents, not teachers, not administrators. We need to answer to the kids. If kids like to go to school, then that school is successful. Well, the only, I suppose, danger in that is you can have all fun and games and make it like liking to go to school. Christine writes, in defense of charter schools, all charter schools must be have a sponsoring district. It is a district school board that demands accountability. They only understand what they currently have in place. Therefore, uniqueness of mission is squashed in favor of academic measures every time. Please stop lumping all charter schools together. Each one has its own mission and is different from every other one.
Well, I try not to lump them all together because the nature of the charter sector is that every charter is different from every other charter unless they're part of a chain. And you have to understand, for example, in California, you do have chain charters. One of the chains is the Gulen chain. The Gulen chain is somehow associated with a reclusive Turkish imam who lives in the Poconos and controls an important political movement in Turkey, oddly enough. And the sign of a Gulen charter is that every single member of the board of the school is a Turkish male. We don't have enough time to discuss why these schools exist, but there are quite a lot of them in California.
And we'll go to more of your calls. We go to North Smithfield, Rhode Island. Marie, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning, Dr. Savage. I'm so excited to speak with you. And it's people like you that have me in my third year of law school hoping to pursue education policy and legislation. So thank you. I was hoping you could comment on how one of the reasons that private schools and potentially charter schools are able to be more nimble is because they're not subject to the bureaucracy, to the government bureaucracy that goes with public education. And also, if you could talk about how in the modern context, academics has been equated with education when there's so much more that goes into educating our children, like arts, like sports, like physical health and nutrition. Thank you.
Well, you know, as an earlier caller said, charters are different. One of the things that they have in common is that because of the No Child Left Behind legislation, which expects that all schools are going to have all children proficient by the year 2014, just a few days, you know, a couple of months from now, everyone's incentivized to get higher and higher test scores. The way that many of the charters do this is that they exclude children with disabilities or with severe disabilities. They limit the number of kids who are English language learners. They say they can't handle them. And then the regular public schools get overloaded with them. If deregulating schools is a great idea, then our public authorities should be deregulating the public schools. Instead, they deregulate the charters and make the public schools, they strangle the public schools with regulation. Sometimes, and I've heard this from many parents, they feel as if they're being forced out of public schools and into charters by public officials who hate public schools. This is happening particularly in many of the southern and midwestern states where these very, very reactionary legislatures are literally strangling public education in the hope of expanding the charter sector and also creating a demand for vouchers.
Let me thank the caller. A Facebook comment from a listener named Nadia. It's about the kids. If a charter is better for my son, that's where he's going. Make public schools better. Everyone who knows their choices and will choose what's right for their family.
Well, that's I think the Facebook comment reflects the consumer mentality. You know, you go to buy your shoes where you find the best quality and the best price. And you abandon the public sector, you abandon the commons, and that is, in fact, what the goal of the privatization movement is to make the public schools so unattractive, to force them to turn kids into data points, to force them to dehumanize the children, and to demoralize teachers by using these phony metrics on teachers, that public schools become unattractive, and we abandon them for the marketplace.
Another listener who writes on Facebook, this is Elena, what about the public-private conundrum? Schools that have a population of parents who can provide a ton of extra funding, thus giving that school added advantage. Within one school in San Francisco with a language immersion program, there is clear segregation and, in turn, learned racism for the students between the two populations.
Well, I think it's very clear that what charter schools do is to increase segregation. We now have a body of research, which I quote in my book, from the UCLA Civil Rights Project, that charters are more segregated than they, even in districts that are segregated, the charters are even more segregated. I think that it's great when parents can have the wherewithal to support their public school, provide extra funding for it, but that makes an even larger obligation on the part of the government to support the schools that don't have wealthy parents and to make sure they have the resources to have small classes, the arts, and all the things that they're now lacking.
I read another comment on our website from Bob, who says, there's something I've never understood about the industrial education establishment. Teaching and learning has been happening for thousands of years. Each year in the United States, I guess hundreds of PhDs are granted in education. Tens of millions of students are in classes at all levels, yet it seems to be a mystery as to the best way to teach. Every few years, some new great breakthrough program is implemented, bazillions spent, then it falls out of favor, and the cycle starts again. Education is as unscientific a field as I can imagine.
Well, you know, what's happened is, and I think the listener refers to this, is we now have this educational industrial complex. There was a wonderful article yesterday or the day before in the Washington Post written by a teacher who was retiring after 43 years, and he described all the fads that had been visited upon his school. And each of these fads came with a price, with consultants. I don't think in my years, in my 40-plus years of studying the schools, there has ever been a time when there were so many consultants and corporations literally feeding off the public dollars that should be going into schools. But instead, they're getting millions and millions of dollars to close schools and turn them around when they really have never turned around a school in their existence, who are being taught create leaders of people who've never led anything, how to retrain teachers, we just have this huge complex of people feeding off the public education budget when we should have schools that have ample resources and are free of all of the incredibly wrongheaded mandates that are now coming from Washington.
Again, our guest this hour, Diane Ravitch, research professor of education and a historian of education at New York University. Her newest book, her 11th book, is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Here's Annabelle joining us. Annabelle, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I'd just like to share the speaker's thoughts on the standardized, because there are pointed out systems in Korea as an example of, you know, something that the schools in the U.S. should strive to. And, in fact, there are standardized testing done in Korea. And there's in fact, a huge test done at the end of the high school career and the senior year of high school. And kids in high school, they're basically, you know, their whole high school career is geared towards excelling at that test. So I just wanted to see what her thoughts were on that aspect of the Korean school system.
Well, I haven't studied the Korean school system to the extent that I have the Finnish school system. I do know, though, that the Korean school system is one where children's lives are dominated by testing, and kids have after-school prep. It's something that makes them into automatons, as far as I've heard from people who are Korean. I was recently interviewed by a Korean film crew, and we talked about Korean education, and they said they wish their schools were as creative as American schools. I hear the same from Chinese students and Chinese educators who say our lives were dominated by testing. Please don't do what we do. Please don't stop being creative, because we want to be more like you. We want to have creativity. We want originality. And we feel that this culture of testing is destroying our children and turning them into testing robots. We don't want that. We want your creativity. Meanwhile, we're trying to be like them at the same time that they're trying to escape the same conundrum.
Look, you grew up in the New York schools.
No, Texas schools.
Oh, that's right. You're from Texas. But I was thinking about the New York schools because the Regents were always heralded as being, you know, superb kind of testing and creating great students for preparation for the Regents.
Well, the Regents were changed several years ago by one of our state commissioners. He decided that instead of the Regents being an exam for the top kids, that all children had to pass the Regents. So now the Regents have been dumbed down, because if you can't pass five Regents, you can't get a high school diploma. So they're not what they used to be. They used to be a mark of excellence that you were at the top of your class and you were able to pass the history Regents and the English Regents. Now they have to be low enough so that every student can pass them. So they're not what they used to be. They're now just a high school exit exam.
Is there also, I remember an interview that got really hot and contentious with Liz Cheney a number of years ago. She just recently, I was reading, got hot and contentious with Senator Alan Simpson. That's a whole other story, who's supporting the incumbent senator who her daughter's running against, her and Dick Cheney's daughter. But we got in this argument about testing and how much testing might be geared toward seeing history a certain way. And she was of the feeling that the tests were really indeed geared toward, shall we say, what she considered a far too left view of history. Is this a problem from your perspective?
Well, I think that the history test, and I was spent 7 years on the National Testing Board, which is a federal agency. The history questions are actually fairly vapid. What typically happens in history questions is they don't expect that you know much about history. So they'll present you with a graph and they say, can you read this graph? In what year was production higher? Or they'll present you with a cartoon and ask you to interpret the cartoon. So usually with the history test, the information is presented. I don't think there is an issue about indoctrination either of the left or of the right. I have not seen that on a history test. I think that's Len Cheney's fantasy.
We'll go to Napa next. Davinia, good morning.
Good morning. I retired after 38 years because I was handed lesson plans and told my kids would be tested in 6 weeks. I was an English teacher in Fairfield, California. When I started teaching in New York, I had a gifted class. I was 23 years old, taught them 1984. We had an outrageous discussion. When I came to California 4 years later, the kids in California just wanted the right answer. They had already been trained, this is 74, to find the right answer. And my belief is that the idea that education, number one, is to be scientific, that teachers should have some scientific, we all do it this way, is our downfall, because the whole purpose of education is to create human citizens. So I'm not sure what the answer is. I've written articles and books and never published much of them. The articles have been published. And I just think that the whole idea that we're trying to scientificize teaching is the biggest mistake.
Okay, let me go to Diane Ravitch on this.
Okay.
And thank you for the call.
What I think is happening is we are now in a period where people who've never taught and know nothing about education are trying to turn education into a source of big data. And the big data relies on standardized testing. And they will use the big data to close schools, to open schools, to privatize, to cause citizens to lose confidence in public education and turn their kids over to the educational industrial complex, also to sell technological devices and to find profit in education. There's a huge industry, and I describe this in some detail in my book, circling people who are making bets that education is the next emerging market and that there's money to be made there out of the big education budget. What I am urging parents to do as I travel around the country is next spring, let's make this the spring in which millions and millions of people opt out of the state test. Just don't take them. Don't show up. Bring the machine down. Don't let it happen.
You are a subversive, aren't you?
I am a subversive. And I am saying because I have a grandchild in public school who's in the second grade, and I want to save the system before it's too late for my grandchild, not with my grandchild.
Since you're talking about action where your grandchild is concerned, I just want to read a couple more comments to make some salient points. Kathleen says, this may be naive, but perhaps all schools would have a better chance of performing better if schools were not so heavily funded based on property taxes. As it stands, schools in areas of concentrated poverty get less funding, and schools in more affluent areas get more. Talk about being set up to fail. Why not start revising how we fundamentally fund our schools? And another listener, Richard, emails, schools will be better when the American worker is treated better. High unemployment, workers' insecurity, weak unions, et cetera, make parents not able to pay attention to their children and their studies as much as they should.
Let me say, Michael, that I think a lot of what we're discussing is a great distraction from the high poverty and dramatic income inequality in our society.
Good to have you with us. Again, the new book is Reign of Error. She'll be at Stanford's University's Memorial Auditorium tonight at 6 p.m. Thank you for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. And our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.